So as I was saying earlier, there have been not one but multiple meetings and efforts to reach out to the government. The personal meeting with the Moya and the latest being, well, the NRIs have met Mr. Vahala Ravi, and we of course have met Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs has set up a subcommittee looking into NRI managers, which is headed by Mr. Nirmal Singh, and we just met them on the 25th of July and made a presentation. There's personal meetings with the Ambassador of India and United States, several communications to the Secretary and other Moya officials, the Council General of India, memorandums to Moya and the Ambassador, and several comments spanning various months. And I'll just show them to you. Here are the dates. November 13, 2005, we actually began meeting them and telling them that, look, it's not just NRI abandoned rights. I'm certain there are some, but there are NRI abandoned rooms here as well, with complaints against wives who they've been cheated, they've been harassed, they've been extorted. So, at them consistently in 2006, in 2007, April, May, June, various meetings with Rakshak members. To no avail, I might add. Here are all the comments on Moya's website, which have been posted, some of them by these very victims that you heard from. And Moya has responded by actually taking away the site at which you can post your comments. So we from Rakshat have certain suggestions and recommendations, and this is what we would like the government to do, basically to adopt a gender-neutral policy in laws related to marriage. Currently, the laws are so gender biased that Moya or the government of India does not even accept that there can be men who are also being cheated. They must be made, all these gender biased laws must be made civil and not criminal laws. All over the world, marriage or anything to do with marriage is considered under the civil jurisdiction. Only in India that marriage is under the criminal jurisdiction. They should also be made bailable and compoundable. There should certainly be a permission to return to the place of employment. Now, this is a basic right of an individual, a right to live with liberty, a right to live with dignity, and a right to earn his livelihood under Article 13. You cannot take this right away just because he's an NRI and force him to forego his employment, to forego his passport, and come and stay in India for the next 10, 12, 15 years, however long the judiciary system would like to take, in order for the cases to reach some conclusion. There should be no revocation or impoundment of passports. No lookout card, no Interpol red corner notices. These are husbands that we're talking about. We're not talking about dreaded criminals and terrorists here. Time-bound trial in marriage-related NRI issues, because these are, after all, young people. They're people in the productive age group. You cannot take their lives and put it on hold next 10, 15 years. It's as if marriage has failed and now you're going to give them no chance at another marriage or maybe having a happy family life or maybe having children. They need to get on with their lives. There should be some kind of a time frame to these cases. Strict and stringent penalties if it's finally found out after a trial that the case that had been lodged was a false case. At the present time, even if you lodge a false case, there is absolutely no payback. The girl is not even rapped on the knuckle. She said, oh, it was a false case. All right, you're acquitted and okay, you can go away, no problem. No arrest of NRI family in India, because most of these cases, even the jurisdiction is not India. Where the spouses are living abroad, women very conveniently run to India and frame false cases and false charges and implicate families who've not even lived with them under these laws. Assistance in legal representation in India in the form of video conferencing or other electronic means. Now, just because you have passed laws whereby NRIs cannot come to India and fight their case, you're going to take away their passports. You're not going to allow them to go back to their job. They don't want to come here and ruin their lives. And so the government paints them as some kind of criminals who are absconding, who are trying not to face this law or trying not to come to trial. That is not the case. Most of these men would want to fight their cases. They want the truth to come out. Because you take passports and take away their right to live, because you take away their, you incarcerate them in prisons, that is the reason why they don't come. You can just make laws or make it easier for them to fight their cases, video conferencing, electronic means. All of them, I'm certain, would like to represent their cases. affidavits under penalty of perjury by spouses must be taken. If the female is lying, she must be punished. If the boy is found to be lying, he must be punished. The whole idea is you must punish the guilty and you must protect the innocent. There should be a mandatory prenuptial agreement. This, I don't know if it's going to work or not, because prenuptials, at least at this present time, are not recognized by our country. Compulsory registration of marriages with a list of the gifts exchanged must be made compulsory. Because today, even somebody who spends 1 lakh, tomorrow when the marriage fails, claims to have spent 1 crore on the marriage. No arrest unless absolutely necessary, as in if there is definite proof of physical harm, certainly arrests may be made, but they should not be made solely on the oral testimony of one person. Fair and balanced reporting and studies by the Indian government. And here, of course, I'm referring to the fact that when there is no proof, media reports of 30,000 abandoned brides and all such other biased reports should be discouraged. Respect the jurisdiction. For example, a spouse, as you just heard, somebody whose spouse has lived with him in the US, comes to India and files a domestic violence case. How does she make jurisdiction? How can you file a domestic violence in India when you have purportedly lived with your husband in the United States always? And how then, which court of law is going to decide whether domestic violence happened or not? If it happened in Connecticut, how do people in India know whether it happened or not? So if at all this case was to be registered, it should have been registered in the US. There is a reason why it's not registered in the US. In the US, in order to prove your case, you will have to bring evidence, which in a false case may be difficult. So basically, we found that the obsession to migrate to foreign shores is one of the root causes wherein people will actually use illegal means, will cause immigration fraud, will lie in terms of concealing material facts about their age, their educational status, and so on and so forth, and therefore will lead to a failed marriage, which maybe later on is called a fraudulent marriage. Several illegal travel agents and marriage bureaus have flourished because of this strong desire to migrate abroad. And this is especially so in the case of Punjab. And I'll tell you, I have the numbers that the Punjab police has actually cited of the number of false agencies or travel agents who are working with these immigration rackets. And in the year 2005, the Punjab police has registered 594 cases against these, under which 655 travel agents were arrested. In 2006, 751 cases were filed, under which 755 travel agents were booked. And in the year 2007, between January to March, already 159 cases have been registered and 57 travel agents have been arrested. Now this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is actually only the travel agents whom they found out were committing immigration fraud. There are a huge number that they have no idea who are actually still working in Punjab and also in other parts of the country. So basically what we are saying is that the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs should have well documented evidence of the number of women victims of fraudulent NRI marriages before they bring in any more legislation, which is probably even more biased than the legislation which is already present. Now, 152 complaints is what they have today. 152 complaints from a diaspora of close to 25 million can hardly be called an alarming situation. You have to understand that some marriages will fail, no matter what you do. And the contention that every case of an abandoned bride is due to harassment or dowry demand is really oversimplistic. I've already pointed out there are so many issues with the NRI marriages and why such marriages fail. And they happen due to a variety of reasons, and both men as well as women are responsible for the same. Moya, first of all, needs to be gender neutral. It has to at least accept that there may be some men who are also being duped, cheated, extorted, harassed, and they have to begin taking complaints from men also. When we made this suggestion, Moya said, no way. It's only women who are ever cheated. Men never fall to such kind of fraud. Government should extend necessary support to abandoned spouses, which is regardless of gender. Currently, they have brought out a new policy wherein $1,000 is being given to every NGO who brings in a complaint from a female who claims to be an abandoned NRI client. Any study that is undertaken or legislation that is proposed in the future by the government or by the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs must make at least some attempt to be gender neutral. Thank you. And now we will go and go ahead with the question and answer session. So whatever questions that you might have, you can go ahead and ask. Avinash?
Yes, thank you. I didn't really completely hear that, but it looks to me that the suggestion made was that we should make representations to various government committees. Is that what the suggestion was? Sukma said, we have actually made several representations. We have met the ambassador to India, Mr. Rohan Sen. We are in direct touch with the Consulate General of San Francisco. We have any visiting dignitary that comes here, we try to arrange a meeting and actually apprise them of our concerns. All we're asking for is that the law should be gender neutral and the innocent should be protected and the guilty should be punished.
Did you tell them about minister when I met him?
And then it's decided at the end of a trial that okay, you were acquitted because you were not guilty. This is official data. Official conviction figures of 498A are 2%. Well, yes, and the number of cases that are settled is about 11%. Is about 11%. Even if you consider that 11%, with the official government percentages, that's why it's close to 80%, because they count those 11% as well. But you have to understand that every case that is settled is not settled because the person is guilty. It's settled because some of them are NRIs and they don't want to ruin their life for the next 10 years, or some people are just plain scared. They have parents who are 80 years old, they don't want them running into court. They have sisters who are pregnant, who go to prison, they settle under that jurisdiction. There are so many reasons for settling. And you think about it, anybody who's fighting can look at the next 15 years of his life would be put on hold. You go to a trial court, you begin in a trial court. In fact, before you begin trial, it's going to take something like 3 years. Because the gap between when a complaint is put and your charge sheet, it could be as much as 3 years. And it is in many cases because they try and prolong it, knowing that they don't have good evidence. Now, after that, you go to trial court and your trial begins, maybe 5 years it will take, and then she challenges if you're acquitted, and then you go to high court, it will take another couple of years, then she challenges that, you go to Supreme Court. It's never ending. So a lot of cases are settled because people just don't want to be in that ponderous legal system, you know, which will ruin your life. Even if you're acquitted at the end of it, who is going to compensate you for years and years of misery? You know, the expense of litigation, you know what lawyers do, there's a huge amount of, you know, implications to a false case. That's what I'm trying to say. The government collects no such complaints. We have 700 cases from NRI men who claim to have been cheated by their wives. Well, abandoned, I told you that the official figures are 152 in India, in the government official. Now, abandoned brides, per se, would be going to the government or to the NCW or to the WCD, who are much more receptive to their complaints. I'm not saying that Raksha would not be receptive, but then we don't give any monetary benefits, and the only kind of support we can give is, you know, we can give legal advice and emotional support, and that is all. Whereas NCW would be able to give them $1,000 as well. The NGO, it actually goes to the NGO who brings in a complaint, that's what I said. But now what percentage of that actually reaches the making question, then we can't answer. That's it. Well, the number is not very large, and primarily one of the reasons... No, she's talking about women. Well, yes. Well, he's right in the sense that when you have a man who complains, there are at least two, maybe many more, maybe five, maybe six, but there are at least two women who are always named in the complaints. One is his sister, the evil sister-in-law, and one is his mother, the even more evil mother-in-law. So at least two women with every man. We have about 3,000 complaints, 4,000, Sudhir. So at least 8,000 women would be much, much more than that, because there'll be two sisters or, you know, sister-in-laws, etc., etc., all of whom are named. Now, of course, referring to your question, which is a more pointed question as to how many women come to us, not many do. Again, for the simple reason that there are so many fora that they can go to, you know. No, women who've been falsely implicated, no, not really. So those are the cases who would come to us, and they are a large number, you know, 10,000, maybe more. Because like I said, with every man who's implicated, at least two women, maybe four, maybe five women.
Like, so I have possessed before entry number, I think
Well, we don't believe it's a National Commission for Women. We'd like to think it is a National Commission for Wives, because after all, the mother-in-law, the sister-in-law, they're all women. But
so
if you...
Commission for Wives? Or
yes.
Commission for
we agree, it is National Commission for Wives.
Anukma,
is there any questions for NRI? Because they're waiting to answer.
Hey, Anukma, I would like to add some incident over here. So I had personally met Sri Vayala Ravi, the minister for MOIA, during his visit to Los Angeles last year here in the USA. I mentioned to him about all these problems which NRIs have to go through and how they are falsely implicated and how they are the soft targets. And he had the answer for me, which was very surprising. He mentioned that, I understand you guys are harassed, I understand that women are getting more assertive, but he cannot afford to have women organizations like NCW do a dharna or a demonstration outside his office. So that the message was very clear that he is actually afraid of NCW and other women organizations. Now I would like to add another point over here, how this jurisdiction plays a very important role and how people are actually misusing this jurisdiction. There was actually, the news is already there on 498.org. Last year in Russia, in Moscow, a lady slipped out of a high-rise building and died. Russian police investigated the whole case and they published that this was accident, and that she had slipped and there was no malintention over there. The husband and his family, who were living in Russia, came back to India with the body of the wife, and they were arrested on the Calcutta airport with the charges of dowry death and 498A. Now, there were the press report in Russia, in a Russian newspaper, which said the Russian police actually investigated and found the case to be accident. And there was a report in Times of India, I think, after 3 days, which had exactly the same story, but said that the husband was arrested of 498A. And dowry, because he had killed his wife for dowry. So these two things I actually wanted to mention to everyone out there, how misinformation is misinterpreted by the people over there and how biased these things get against the NRIs, because there is no very simple or easier way to corroborate the story of the wife, whatever she is saying in India, to you know, the version of NRI. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yes, 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 absolutely. Satya, would you like to comment on the background of the people who
saw
sure.
Sure.
Satya, hold on.
Change
the next
way.
Take the next question.
Most of the guys whose stories. Can you actually repeat the question for me, Anupma? Can you repeat the question for me, Anupma?
Yeah, the question was that she says that we've heard stories, but just names of people, nothing about their background.
Actually, there must be some pamphlet about the whole case studies in which we have listed out the background, the educational institute, where they are working, and around their age, etc. Age is not mentioned.
We mailed it to them, sir. She also wants to know what is the background of the wife.
Okay, some of them are highly educated. They have actually in US alone, we had cases of at least 13 or 14 women who have filed 498 in India who are fully qualified MBBS, are doctors. Some of them have BTech degrees. So we are talking about women who are fully educated. It's not that they are helpless. It's not that they don't know what to do, where to do, and how to get help from the authorities in case there are problems in the domestic life. So most of the women who have, or most of the cases we have received of the NRIs, in almost 100% of the cases, these women were highly educated and were at least 12th educated. In more than 80-90% of the cases, they were either BTech or BSc.
Okay, I'll just qualify that statement a little bit, Satya. I had actually sat down and divided them from based on the information that they got. We have a questionnaire that most of these victims have to fill in. And we found that at least 80% of them were postgraduates. Most of them were either engineers, they were doctors. Very small percentage was, just graduates, BAs and pre-coms and things like that. About 10% of them were actually post-doctoral. So we're talking about women here who know about their rights, who know how to work the laws, who can misuse the laws, and they know which jurisdiction it would be easier to misuse them to. So despite the fact that they could easily do this in the United States or whichever country they resided, there are very stringent domestic violence laws in the US wherein you just have to make a phone call and the entire machinery, stops. Again, the domestic violence in the United States is a law under which, just like criminal laws in India, there are very strict penalties. So any accusation of domestic violence, and you could lose your house, you could lose child custody, there are restraining orders wherein you cannot even come within a certain radius of your children and your wife. So these are very, very strict laws.
Yes, so
despite that, despite the fact that they can use those laws, they have the jurisdiction to use them,
And the reason, if Anupma, I may add something to this, the reason for this is primarily because the penalty of perjury in the US is...
You cannot just walk into a police station, claim to be abused, and have the entire criminal machinery set in action against whoever you're complaining about. That's the other thing. Satya, do you want to answer this?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Yes, do the men, do the victims have evidence against their wives?
All of the people you just talked to, they all have pretty solid evidence against their wives. So there are medical reports. I'll list out one particular example in which the wife of this victim was diagnosed with schizophrenia, which is a valid ground for divorce even in India. He sought medical help for her, got her admitted into the hospital where she had a nervous breakdown, still he supported her all the way, 3 months, whatever. Then this woman went to India and filed a 498A. And in fact, when I'm saying this, I have all the documents with me in front of me to prove this. She then went to India, filed a 498A, and in the FIR, she has mentioned that he forcibly actually got her admitted into the hospital on the pretext that she was mad while she was not mad.
See, to just add a little bit to this, if there's a case in India but there's no case in the US, so chances are pretty high that it's a false case. The reason for not filing a case in US would be because the penalty of perjury law is very strict over here. If you make a false complaint and eventually it's discovered it is false, then you get into trouble with the law. While they don't get into trouble in the law in India, that's the reason they go to India and file the case. So if there's a case in... Yeah, go ahead.
Let me interrupt.
Sure.
She just wants to ask another question.
Okay.
I think I can answer that. I am a medical doctor, and schizophrenia is a condition wherein it is not mental retardation. It's not as if you cannot be educated and have schizophrenia. In fact, you may know, A Beautiful Mind was made on a brilliant person. It's been found that people who are extremely brilliant are also more prone to have mental illnesses like schizophrenia. They would go through phases of stress. In fact, schizophrenia is something which would probably be uncovered during an extremely stressful period. They could be perfectly normal, have an education, have a decent job, and suddenly go through something that is stressful, have the schizophrenia, be alert, and from then on, it's a downward. So once full-blown episode of schizophrenia, then you move down the social ladder, you move down employment ladder, and from there on it is a downward spiral unless you're treated.
Is there any way to show that schizophrenia?
No. I think that if that's the impression we've given, then that's probably not what we are trying to say. It's not correct. We're just trying to say this is one of the ways that the law is misused. Now here is a person who's schizophrenic, whose parents probably knew that before they married her off to somebody. This person was not informed that there is a mental condition to your wife. Now, obviously, when he finds out, then rightfully, he has issues with the marriage or may ask to be, maybe does not want to be in that marriage anymore. Then a 498A being lodged. Up until this time, there are no issues. But the moment the person asks for a divorce, a 498A is lodged. Now, 498As are not just lodged in order to get a more favorable settlement. That is one thing. But they also lodge sometimes to arm twist the spouse from taking back his divorce. Many times parents will say, so what? She's now your responsibility. Don't send her back to us, and they'll lodge a 498A to try and pressure you into, don't divorce her, take her back. So we're not trying to say they're all mad. In fact, most of them are not mad. So these are just one of the ways in which it would be misused when a mental condition or a physical health condition is found out by the husband which he was not informed prior to marriage. Then just in order to, as an arm twisting tactic, 498 would be used again.
Hey, Anupma. Anupma.
She was talking about paranoid schizophrenia, and she was talking about this movie, A Beautiful Mind. In that particular movie, it was about a person's life history, Dr. John Nash. Now, he was a Nobel laureate, but he was again mad. It is very difficult to say. No. There are plenty of exceptions like that. There are plenty. There are even an Indian, as I forgot his name.
Okay, Anupma. Hello?
Yes.
Anupma?
Satya?
Yeah, what's the question?
The question is, do you know if any of these NRI men took dowry?
All the cases we get, we have a question, did you take dowry? And the answer we have is, no, we did not take dowry. Now, it is very important for me to mention over here is, most of these NRI men are self-made people. They are graduates of IIT or IIM, or they are even doctors. So they have made their own destiny, and they are earning pretty well over here, with, or to the tune of $100,000 to $150,000 per year. I would like to cite another example over here, and I can send you the story. This is about an NRI doctor who makes more than $500,000 a year. That amounts to about 2.5 crore, or, you know, with dollar to rupee ratio now, about 2 crore a year. He got his divorce done in the US, was married to a US citizen who was actually born in India, got married in the US, got divorced in the US, had two kids. The wife, after the divorce, abducted the kids to India, filed a 498A against him, accusing him of torturing her for a dowry of $12,000. Now, a person who is making $500,000 a year is accused of harassing the wife for $12,000 in a marriage of 4 years. Now, a lot of these, I would like to mention Indian marriages, and all of those who are sitting over there very well know, is a very gala and big affair in the life of any man or woman. And Indians, they do spend a lot of money in marriages. And most of the time there are gifts that are exchanged. But it is very important to notice that whenever there are problems in the marriages, magically those gifts that were, you know, given or exchanged at the time of marriage, saying that these are gifts and we are giving it to our own daughter for her own happiness, now are termed as, you tortured my daughter for these dowry articles. Anyone, any of our esteemed members over there, can you actually tell what is a gift and what is dowry? And that too when there are two families fighting with each other.
Yes, that's exactly what he's trying to say. That gifts which were willingly given in marriage, because at that point it's a social thing. I gave my daughter this much, I gave her so much jewelry, etc. Suddenly when the marriage sours, becomes, these were given under duress because I was asked to give. See, this is, it's very convenient to switch facts around because it allows you to do it. It allows you to do it and encourages you to do it. When you do it, chances are you're going to settle the account. You said that none of them have taken dowry.
No, but the children don't say that.
Well, if no. No, well, if there's a 498 hanging on your head, there is nobody who's stupid enough to say that. But the fact is that just like these men say that we didn't take dowry and you didn't believe it, there are women who say we gave dowry, but how do you know? Yeah, obviously, nobody is going to say that. But what I'm trying to say is, even assuming that what you're saying is true, and men who are earning 100,000 plus are asking for dowries of $5,000 or $10,000, assuming that that is true, what I'm trying to say is that this is a huge lure for parents. When they're looking for a groom for their daughter, it's like, I want an NRI groom, and I'm willing to spend so much in order to get this, and I'm going to give him this and I'm going to give him that. So why then, if you believe that they are all cheats and out to dupe your daughter, why is it that parents here are so keen to spend large amounts of money and use that as a lure in order to marry off their daughters to these men who are cheats? Despite so many media reports and despite so much anti-NRI propaganda, why is it that it is still considered such a good marriage? Is that right?
So,
is that correct? I mean, you have reports saying that... No. I'm talking of media reports. I'm not talking about you, per se. I'm just saying when there are reports that are saying that there are 30,000 NRI... I think that there was a recent statement by... because the minister of WCD went on record saying that these are men who are just out to cheat women and dump them. That's exactly my point, that he claimed there were 30,000 cases when there are 152. The numbers speak for themselves. Yes.
We are not talking about this from
yes, of course. And I, in fact, did enumerate them, but I'll just go back to my slide as to what we found in our study were the commonest reasons for failed marriages or such allegations to be made. And I'll just come to it.
Satya, are you online?
Yes, I am.
So okay. There are the major reasons, which I said earlier, but I'm just going to quickly go. Concealment of material facts, like I said. There is concealment, and mainly because an NRI marriage is considered a good marriage in the marriage market. Little status could be about education, age, health conditions, medical history. A lot of times women have their own academic ambitions wherein they would, you know, especially in such case, who's a homemaker. Am I correct, Satya?
Yes.
He made it very clear that he wanted to marry someone who would stay at home and be a homemaker. A huge amount of money. Most people would take huge loans and would have to pay it off for a large part. So a lot of them do have their own academic ambitions. They want to acquire foreign degrees and they want to do it when their spouse is to pay for it, which is perfectly fine. Given marriage and given that there would be no arm twisting, spouses would usually be happy to do it for their wife. Leading a life, a lavish lifestyle, they have this sees an NRI, he's flush with funds, and I would never have to do a moment's or never have to do face any hardship in life. Not true. Life of an NRI is more difficult because you have no domestic help. Right from cleaning the toilets to cooking to doing the utensils, you have to do everything. That may not be a lifestyle which is very conducive to the kind of imagery they have in their mind before they get married. Launching an NRI status in the community, it's considered a big deal that you're married, you've married your daughter to an NRI. Gain entry into foreign lands, again, for whatever reason. Immigration is a huge issue. They, not only do they want to immigrate themselves, they then want you to sponsor their entire family. Sponsor my brother, get him a job, set him up here. He's not doing well in India, or sponsor my entire family. And in many cases, like I've written here, they already have lovers or paramours abroad, and they only use the husband for immigration and then reunite with. And there are, we have annexures in which we have cases where it's been proved that they've gone and then started living with somebody else. Extort money, of course, and maybe this is not premeditated, but when they figure out that yes, this marriage is souring or this marriage is going to fail, then in order to get the maximum mileage out of the marriage or get the most favorable settlement, false charges are used. Because the more people you implicate under the false charges, the greater the chance of getting a better settlement. And of course, to seek a hefty alimony, again, if you have a no false divorce, your alimony is not likely to be as good as if you resort to certain false charges. Anything you'd like to add, Satya?
No, I think you are pretty much online there. One more thing actually I wanted to add here is, and this might sound a little funny to people sitting over there. When I went to India to get married, that was about 2 years ago, I had very strict criteria, no single paisa in dowry. I make my own money, I make good money, I'm a senior manager at a very reputed institute. And I graduated from IIT and did my MS from a well-credible institute, and I was working with a professor who was nominated for the Nobel Prize. Okay, I went to India to get married. My parents had, looked for prospective matches on the internet. I talked with some girls. I did not like one of a lot of them, and one of them, when I said no, I don't think this is going to work out, and half an hour of my interaction with the girl, her father came back and said, "Sab, aap haan keh dijiye, hum 20 lakh laga denge." I said, "No, this is not about money. I don't think we are compatible." Then finally I chose a girl from a very lower middle class. They live in a one bedroom apartment in Delhi. And what I heard during my marriage is the guy must be impotent because he did not take a single paisa in dowry. So this is the example we set when we don't ask for a single paisa in dowry, that there must be some physical problem with the guy. That's why his family is not asking for money.
Okay, Satya, Ravi wants to ask you a question. Go
sure.
ahead, Ravi. Satya,
he wants to ask, if he has got the list of remittances that is coming across the world,
yeah, probably. Okay. All right, I'm going
on. Have you ever raised the question if a doctor will be getting the problem
Anupma, can you repeat the question?
Yeah. What Ravi is saying is that in terms of bringing money back into the country, NRIs have a huge hand in it.
Mm-hmm.
So have you ever sort of spoken to any ministers or the government saying that, okay, we're bringing in so much remittance into the country, so why are these laws, these gender bias laws, being framed? Or
also, it has a negative effect on the...
Negative effect on the money flowing back into India.
Okay, so let me take a stab at it. I did discuss a little bit of this with Vela Ravi, the MOIA minister. And I asked, why are you guys making these gender bias laws? Does it help anyone? I mean, with every woman, every man implicated, there are women who are implicated with it. He said, I have to be very honest and it's off the record. It's all vote politics. Okay. Then, get asked and talked around with other people about what is the remittance or what is the effect on the remittance, whatever India is bringing in because of the NRIs. That actually matrimonial purpose is totally different from businessmen. Okay? Now, I was talking to a guy who was falsely implicated. He is vice president, or he was a vice president of a very large company. He said, "I am falsely implicated, but still, if I see, if I invest in India for 100,000, I get 500,000, in a year, I would make money." So business is different from matrimony. He would not go and marry with a girl in India because he potentially would see all these problems which he has already seen in his first marriage. But what I'm trying to say is, we NRIs are very small fish in this whole money-making business. But yes, the people I have talked to here in the US, Canada, Australia, UK and Middle East, they say, "I am not going to invest in India because of these things." And also, I married the girl from India because I wanted to cherish the Indian culture, I wanted to preserve it, I wanted to have my kids and babies learn Indian culture, but I don't think it's worth it at the stake of my parents, my elders and the other family members. What is the example Indian government is setting by having these gender bias laws? Now, I wanted to emphasize to everyone out there that this problem is not specific to NRIs. 498A, the misuse of dowry laws, is very much very evident in every city in India. And despite a lot of protest from all these people, Indian government is not doing anything about it. And to add to all this, Mr. Arjun Singh is recently implicated in a dowry case, and strangely enough, Renuka Chaudhary has come to the rescue of the minister, saying that this is a false case. Oddly enough, about a year ago when Karan Thapar in a live interview on Devil's Advocate asked the same question about the falsely implicated people, she said, "We will think about it when the time comes." And she has on record on TV mentioned this specific statement that it's now men's turn to suffer. I don't know if that all adds any relevance to this, but I would not like to have our politicians stoop down to this level and say that, you know, it's now men's turn to suffer. Are we actually, we have already divided our society in the name of caste, religion, men poor, like financially, and now these politicians have started this gender war also.
Okay, any more questions? When a 498A is put in against, a complaint is pressed against an NRI, then basically what happens is that a lookout card can be offered, that is, if the NRI ever travels to India, then there's a lookout card at the airport for him, and he can actually be arrested as soon as he enters the country. And Interpol red corner notices are similar things which are given to the Interpol in order to, it's a notice. Just like you have red corner notices for terrorists and dreaded criminals, when the Interpol looks out for them, the same thing is also for 498A accused. For the accused, mind you. They are not guilty, they are only accused of a crime. At the end of this entire thing, 98% of these so-called accused with lookout cards and Interpol red corner notices against them are going to be acquitted.
Satya?
Yes.
Have you ever tried to bring Arjun Singh and Bhupesh Singh Hooda in your 498?
Actually, Arjun Singh is a very new person in this, but our representative had met Bhupinder Singh Hooda because he was implicated in the dowry case. I would not say false or true, but with his status and all, he was able to go scot-free within 3 months. He said, "I can support you, but I cannot help you publicly."
His son is also an MP now.
His son is MP. We tried to reach him. We could not reach him.
No, see, here's one point I'd like to make is that why is there so much dichotomy? Even if you have a law, at least follow that law honestly, or with some amount of sincerity. While any common man, his pregnant sisters, his elderly parents, his minor nephews and nieces are all hauled off to prison as soon as an FIR is registered, why is Arjun Singh still out and why is he a free man today? And why is the minister standing and saying this is gross misuse of the law? And he is a very respected person of our society. What are his credentials towards being respectable, which the common doctor, techie, engineer does not have? What have we not done in order to not have the respectable credentials that he's done for the country? And surely, I mean, all of us here would agree that we would not like to call politicians respectable. So even a law, there is so much dichotomy. For one person it's something, but for another person it's quite another thing. So even that, even whatever law, however biased it is, even that is not followed, you know, judiciously or with sincerity. So that's what we're trying to say. You've imposed so much faith in women that they will not complain falsely. And police, look at your investigation agency. They'll do anything for money. Whoever gives them more money, that's where they're going to go. So how then is this law? It's worse than panchayati law. At least in panchayat, you know, there are 5 people who sit together and say, "Ha, ah, aisa, aisa, aisa." But what is this? This is no law at all. This is jungle law.
Anupma, I would like to add a little bit more about the Ministry of Overseas Indian Affairs here and how really helpless we feel when we try to approach them about any of these things.
Right. Go ahead.
MOIA was made for non-diplomatic interactions with the people living outside of India and to listen to their issues and, you know, find out how India can have better relationships with the people of its origin. MOIA has come up, actually it was about a year and a half ago, they came up with a booklet about marriage to overseas Indians, which was, if any sane person would read it and, you know, would think that these guys have gone mad. There were things that were written in that booklet that looked like every marriage would end up in a disaster if you marry an overseas Indian. And it started, actually Anupama, we have a link to the original booklet which unfortunately was prepared by National Commission for Women. Okay, the original booklet said, the first chapter said, you know, NRI marriages may be a, you know, your road to heaven, but not in every case, it may be a stepping stone into a hell. And also they came out with all these fictitious examples of how a woman may be harassed and tortured and not given any food in places like Canada and the USA. We held a lot of protests, we sent a lot of emails, letters to MOIA, and in fact on their website they had this forum in which people could type in whatever they had to offer for this issue. For over a year or so, there were about 700 comments written by NRI. There was not a single response from the ministry to anyone who posted the comments over there. There was no overview of those comments, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing done to make sure that those issues were actually even considered. MOIA, in conjunction with National Commission for Women, organized two or three workshops about this issue of abandoned brides. In all of these, they invited whoever or whatever women organizations they wanted to invite, and they badmouthed NRIs and said, you know, they are doing this and they are maybe dowry hungry mongers and they spend 15 days with our brides and go back to their respective countries. Interestingly, they were talking about all these overseas Indians without even a single representative from NRI community. They are making laws without even discussing, without even considering whatever is right there in their website. People had written so many comments, they were literally crying over there that, you know, I did a mistake by marrying a woman of Indian origin. And here I'm talking to the minister who is responsible for this whole show, who is saying I'm afraid of women organizations. And to add to all that, they have sanctioned 3 crore rupees for next fiscal year and actually 2 crore rupees in this year to help women in the foreign land to file cases against their husband if for whatever reason within 2 years of the marriage there was a divorce filed against them. We actually had to talk to the all the way to the secretary for just an appointment, and which they kept delaying for months in order for us to go give a representation to them, in which Dr. Anurupama had gone, and we were branded as anti-woman, all because we wanted to raise that there is a severe discrepancy between whatever ministry says on the parliament. That is, you know, in year 2005 there were only 18 cases, 18 cases received by MOIA about abandoned brides. Now these were only complaints. You cannot say that these are abandoned brides. I in fact tried to ask the ministry, what is your definition of abandonment? And these guys don't even have a definition for abandonment. So clearly, we are trying to reach out to the Indian government and they are totally ignoring us. Not only ignoring us, they are making policies and laws on false statistics, baseless assumptions, and making laws that would hurt NRI interests. what are the, what is the example ministry is trying to set?
Okay, Satya.
Yeah.
I think we've pretty much wrapped it up.
Sure.
We're going to start the video now.
Sure.
So I think that's it. Okay, Satya, we're done. We're starting the video now.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for giving us a patient listening. And we just hope through our esteemed media organization, we would be able to reach our ministers and ministry. Avinash, you have anything to add?
No, I guess we have everything covered over here. Thank you guys for attending.
Okay, thank you so much. And bye.